But we are glad that you are here this morning. And we are going to be continuing on with kind of this look at the latter part of Job. We're going to be in Job chapter 40 and chapter 41 today. A lot of scripture, a lot of things to look at here. But I want to ask you this question, okay? Have you ever wanted to say to God, "God, that's not fair"? So if you just laugh, that's the funniest thing. I asked that question. I said, "Have you ever wanted to say to God, 'God, that's not fair'?" And some of you couldn't help it. You bust out laughing, right? Because we've done that, haven't we? Haven't we always wanted to just throw up our hands and go, "God, okay, that is not fair"? You ever be that? You ever in those places? You know, we've been looking at the book of Job, and that's been a lot of what Job has been dealing with, a lot of what he's been talking about. When we started this whole thing off 3 weeks ago, we talked about Job in chapter 28, and he's looking at when this is his last little speech before God's going to answer. And in chapter 28, he's going, "Where can wisdom be found?" He's trying to grasp that. He goes, "Look, I can't see any wisdom in this. I can't see anything in this, and I don't understand what is going on. And all I want is wisdom, but it's fleeting. It's not there. I can't find it anywhere." And then 2 weeks ago, we looked at the latter part of Job's talking when he's trying to find that answer to why, right? This is where Job's questioning is all about, that little three-letter word, why. And Job's just going, "God, why? Well, last week, we kicked off 2 weeks that we're actually looking at when God finally does speak. And we looked at chapters 38 and chapter 39 last week when God finally started talking. And Let me put this up here. I want you to see this because God kind of gives two different speeches. Notice how he begins each speech. He began the first speech that we looked at last week in verse 4 of chapter 38. He said, this is what God told Job. He says, "Get ready to answer me like a man. And when I question you, you will inform me." Right? Can you imagine? Do you want to just sound like the most intimidating thing in the world? Imagine the God who created absolutely everything saying, "Okay, if you're so smart, I'm going to question you, and you are going to inform me." I think from that moment, if I was Job, I would have been, ooh. In fact, we see, as we saw last week at the end of this first little speech, Job says, "God, I've put my hand over my mouth. I've spoken once, and it was too much. I've spoken twice, and I have just gone too far. I am not going to say anything." But then, as we talked about last week, Job gets this question from God. After Job says all that, he goes, "God, I'm putting my hand over my mouth. I don't need to say anything." Let me back up here for a minute. Last week, we looked at how, rather than answer Job's question of why, what God did was ask Job a bunch of questions. Here's the fascinating thing about God's response to Job. Don't you wish God would have just spelled it out and said, "Okay, Job, here's the problem. Here's A, here's B, here's C." But God does not insult Job's intelligence at all. God responds to Job by asking questions and letting Job get the reasons behind all that. He asked Job a bunch of questions to get Job to the place where he needs to be. Here's the thing to understand the speech from God. It's not about understanding why God said that. It's about understanding why Job needed to hear that. Does all that make sense? To understand God's response to Job, you don't need to understand God. You need to understand Job. And so after this first round of questions, when God then takes Job on a tour of creation, and we talked about the mystery of creation last week, and we see God point out the stars. He's pointing out the heavens. He then goes along and points out about 12 or so different animals. Things that live on the fringe of society that Job hasn't even thought about. That Job hasn't put any attention towards. Like ostriches. You know, God spends 6 verses talking about the ostrich. And Job's going, "I've never thought about an ostrich in my life." But yet he saw this incredible thing. Job, who's felt so forgotten by God, understands that God pays attention to everything in creation. Even an ostrich. And even when the ostrich does things that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us, God's questioning leads Job to realize he's happy with the ostrich. He's happy with the way he is. Even if Job doesn't understand it, that's okay. But then you get to God's second speech. You get to chapter 40. Job has put his hand over his mouth. He says, "God, I'm not going to say anything." And then in verses 7 and 8, God starts off the exact same way. He says, "Get ready to answer me like a man. And when I question you, you will inform me." But then God says this to him. He says, "Would you really challenge my justice? Would you declare me guilty to justify yourself?" Now, I think these questions probably just wrecked Job to his core from the very first time he heard them. But here's actually what's going on, because Job hears this repeated charge from God about, be ready to answer me, and when I question you, you're going to inform me. And Job, he's been dealing with so many things here, and he gets asked these two things. Would you really challenge my justice? Would you really accuse me of being unfair, is what God is basically saying to him. Would you accuse me of being unfair? And then the second thing, would you condemn me to justify yourself? Would you be critical of what I am doing? Would you condemn me and throw everything on me in order to make yourself feel better? You kind of catch those two questions? Notice here, this is all about God's justice. Here you've got God who's directly confronting Job about all these questions and all these accusations that you can read over 36 chapters between this dialogue between him and four of his friends, and you see the back and forth, and you see all of those questions. And Job felt that God was being so unfair to him, that God was being unjust to him, to use God's words here, because he's using the word justice. He feels like God has been unfair to allow him to suffer so much in this brief time. You think about it. Job has lost all 10 of his kids. He's lost his entire estate. He's lost all of his livestock. He's lost all the servants in the midst of all this. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, about how his workers, his work hands, his ranch hands, loved him so much that they even saw him as a father figure, and he loved them. He's lost the loss of all of them, on top of his family, on top of his possessions, on top of everything. And now he's got this disease. He doesn't know what it is, and he's not even sure if it's going to kill him. And he just sits around and scrapes boils off of his body with broken pottery. And he's miserable, as he should be, right? So here, to put it simply, Job thinks that God is mistreating him, that God is being unfair, that God is in the wrong, that God is just taking something out on Job that he's not taking out on the rest of the world. And I think the reasoning by Job's argument feels very logical to him, because he truly believed in God. He believes in living a righteous life, and he believes he's been doing the very best that he can. And as far as Job knew, he was not guilty of any kind of deliberate sin. No known sin, no unconfessed sin like his friends were accusing him of. He was completely innocent and completely righteous before God. And he honestly could not understand why God would allow him, one of his followers, one of the people that loves God so much, this true believer in him, and Job doesn't understand why God would let him suffer so tragically. From Job's perspective, this agony, this pain that he's going through feels excessive, it feels unnecessary, it feels undeserved. It feels like God is being unfair. So God is sitting up there and he's hearing all this, and what Job is actually ending up doing is now he's playing the comparison game. A lot of this has been the comparison game. It's been, well, my life is this way, but other people's life is this way, right? My life's here, but other people's life is here. And it's almost this comparison thing here, because what you've got is you've got God's fairness and justice on trial with how he handles evil in the world is basically what's going on. Because look at what God says. He says, will you really challenge my justice? Would you declare me guilty to justify yourself? Put this in other words, Job is saying, God, you have messed up the way you're handling this world. I have been mistreated, and other people who deserve it have not. Right? Anybody ever say those words? Anyone ever say those words today? I'm just saying we're in some pretty good company here. Now I want you to think how Job, now his entire community has rejected him, how even people are just mocking him in his fallen condition. They're going, "Oh man, look at that guy. He's such a loser now," and all this. No one's standing up for Job. No one's trying to stop this, what Job considers this injustice. And Job thought that God should stop this evil behavior of evil people, and he should execute justice in a lot different way than he would have done it if he were God. Right? You ever just feel that way? You're like, hey, we could solve all the world's problems if only I could have a little more power, if I could be in charge. Right? We were joking this morning with Johnny, with Juan and Charlie and I, and you know, we had all the answers that all the world was facing. We were coming up with these ridiculous things for things here in the service, like, you know, Charlie needs to be up in the baptistry when Cheyenne's baptized. They can just step over and lead from the guitar on top of the drum cage, you know, and all these ridiculous things, right? The world would be a really funny thing if some of us were in charge, right? Now here you've got Job, and he's looking at all this. He sees the world around him, and he goes, God, I see the presence of all of this evil, and yet I feel like I'm the one being punished. I see all this unjust stuff going on, and yet I'm the one that's punished. And what he's doing is he's questioning God's justice. He's questioning why God would do what he does. He's questioning God's very reasons here. He's being critical of the way that God was allowing him to suffer and the way that God was allowing him to suffer while others who deserve it weren't suffering. Right? In essence, Job is saying, God, you're not handling my life the way you're supposed to. You know, that's a dangerous thing to say. I mean, it really is. Job here, in his mind, he deserves far better treatment than people that are evil. He deserves far better treatment than the wicked that are still there. They're still healthy. They still have their families. They still have livestock. They still have properties. They still have a way to make a living. And Job has lost all of that. And he's going, God, it is not fair. Why don't you punish evil and reward good? Right? I truly think that the biggest obstacle for people that don't believe in God to believing in God is this idea right here. Why does evil exist in the world? You know how many times we hear that charge leveled towards God, right? Any decent person would get involved to stop something evil from coming. You know, I think if you walked in here this morning and someone was being abusive to a kid, probably every single person in here would get involved. We would do something, right? But it seems like God sometimes sits up there and he doesn't do anything. And yet we go, God, that doesn't make sense because you're supposed to be good. You're supposed to be loving, right? Are you with me on all this? So I want you to see that Job's questions and his friend's dialogue that they've had for 36 chapters goes so much deeper into all of this. And Job is saying, God, I don't understand why bad things happen to good people and why good things happen to bad people. God, I don't understand. And that's been a question that's been asked from so many people for so long. And so I'm going to give you a rough look at where we're going to go today. All right, here's kind of our rough outline. We want you to be able to see that. The first thing you're going to see is God actually asked Job the question, you know, would you crush the wicked? He's actually going to say, what would you do if you were in charge? If you were God, what would you do? From there, you're going to see that God talks about two different creatures. One is known as Behemoth and one is known as Leviathan. We'll talk about what those creatures were here in a minute. But this is where we're going to go. You're going to see that I think Behemoth is really talking about that grace that we need, and Leviathan is about all those fears that we have that tend to drive us. All right? So this is where we're going to go. This is where we're going to be over the next 7 hours for me to get this done. All right? So we better get going because I want you to see this here for a minute. And my mic is still messed up, so I'm trying to do all this one-handed today. So let's look at Job chapter 40, starting in verse 8. I want you to see what God says here. He says, would you really challenge my justice? Would you declare me guilty to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Verse 10, adorn yourself with majesty and splendor and clothe yourself with honor and glory. You know what he's saying? Pretend you're God. All right? Verse 11, notice what God says to Job. Pour out your raging anger. Look on every proud person and humiliate him. Look on every proud person and humble him. And then he says this, trample the wicked where they stand. Job, if you were God, if you could have all those things of God, what would you do? Okay, what would you do? He says, pretend that you have all the honor, you have all the glory, you have all the power, you are me. What would you do? And he says, trample the wicked into the ground, just stomp them right into the dust. Verse 13 says, hide them together in the dust, imprison them in the grave. He kind of catch this picture here. God flat out asked Job, okay, Job, you're going to accuse me of being unfair, so I want to put you in my place. What would you do? Would you crush the wicked? Would you stomp them? Would you just drive them into the dirt where apparently they belong? Right? And I love what God says in verse 14. He says, if you'll do all that, then I'll confess to you that your own right hand can deliver you. Don't you hate it when God puts forth a challenge when you're going, he knows I can't do that, right? But I love this picture because I want you to see this here for a minute. Because Job has been complaining about this apparent inconsistency of God letting him suffer while evil people are prospering. So here you got this picture that actually even three of Job's friends, you have, you know, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, they believed that there needed to be swift punishment for wickedness. They believed that there needed to be this incredible swift punishment that would happen when you sin. And Job's going, but I haven't. And they're going, no, this is the way it should be. But I want you to picture what this would be like. Because certainly, God has every ability to be able to wipe evil off the face of this planet, does he not? He does, doesn't he? Well, why doesn't he just crush the wicked to prove that he is just? Why? In Job here, he's been questioning God's justice, and he gets asked what to do if God's power were in his hand. And I think that Job is looking at all of this, and he's looking at injustice, and he's looking. It's funny because God has now turned the tables on Job, and Job has to say, okay, you're laying this charge against me. What would you do about it? Would you really just crush the wicked? Would you just wipe evil off the face of the earth? I kind of picture Job sitting there going, oh, man. That means my wife would have to be gone. My three friends that have been here, and even though they're putzes, they've been, you know, helpful in some ways. You know, even though they are kind of a jerk, I still love them. They'd have to be gone. Job would have to realize that he himself is even sinful, and he goes, okay, I would have to be gone. Right? You kind of catch this picture here for a minute. You see that God is pointing, he's turning the tables and he's pointing Job to think about, look, these are real people, these are real lives. You need to realize that evil, being on this earth, injustice, all of this kind of thing is more about something greater, right? I love how we get so... We think that life is so unfair. Y'all, I'm not kidding. I'm still bitter that Taco Bueno closed, right? I am. We moved to Brownwood 6 years ago, and I'm like, we can finally have crunchy potato burritos anytime we want. It's amazing, right? It was the greatest injustice ever. I'm still bitter about it. It really wasn't the greatest injustice ever. It really truly wasn't. But I want you to think about the greatest injustice that ever happened was when soldiers showed up to arrest Jesus. All right, now there's something huge to see here in Matthew chapter 26. So actually, in Matthew 26, starting in verse 47, you see this. It says, when he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, suddenly arrived. A large mob with swords and clubs was with him from the chief priests and the elders of the people. And his betrayer, talking about Judas, had given him a sign. The one I kiss, he's the one, arrest him. So immediately, he went up to Jesus and he said, greetings, Rabbi, and he kissed him. And in verse 50, Jesus actually calls Judas. He goes, friend, why have you come? Isn't that fascinating? I want you to picture this here for a minute. Jesus, who always tells the truth, he doesn't tell a lie. Judas comes up to him. And Jesus says, friend, Jesus asked him, why have you come? Then they came, the soldiers, verse 50 here, took hold of Jesus and arrested him. And at that moment, one of those with Jesus reached out with his hand and drew his sword. He struck the high priest servant, and he cut off his ear. You guys remember the story. There's a high priest servant. His name is Malchus. And we know from one of the other Gospels that it was Peter who actually threw his sword and had horrible aim, I guess, or something, took off an ear. And Malchus is laying there bleeding and with this ear here. And then Jesus says this in verse 52 of Matthew 26. He says, put your sword back in its place, because all those who take up the sword will perish by the sword. Are you with me? This is such a huge part of, I think, relates to our story of Job. Jesus goes on in verse 53 and he says, or do you think that I cannot call my Father and he would provide me here and now with more than 12 legions of angels? Here's the point that I think Job is hearing when he has God ask him, what would you do? Would you wipe out wicked people? Would you wipe out anybody who's ever done something wrong? Would you just say, all right, you're done. You're off this earth. I think through this line of questioning, Job is beginning to realize that grace is part of the character of God. That grace is part of who God is. And I think Job is beginning to realize that if he's exercising this swift and quick justice upon the wicked, that none of us would be worthy of it. That there's more going on with grace than what we realize, right? These two things, I think Job is beginning to realize, go hand in hand. The fact that evil exists and the fact that grace exists cannot be separated, I think, in the mind of Job at this point. I think he begins to see that line of questioning. And what's fascinating is that then God actually gives Job a lesson from Behemoth, right? Behemoth, which is a kind of a fascinating thing. So notice here in verse 15, God asks this. He tells Job, he says, look at Behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like cattle. All right, so I want to talk about what Behemoth was. There are various different ideas about what Behemoth and what Leviathan are. There's a whole lot of scholars. Some people are going to say these are mythological creatures. They don't actually exist. You can make a pretty good case for that. Other people are saying, okay, these are just some other type of creature that we're seeing. I do think that these are probably real-life creatures. The reason why is because God, in the previous chapter, actually talked about 12 different animals. I think it was 12. They're all real animals, nothing mythological here. And now God tells Job here from the start, he goes, I want you to look at Behemoth. I want you to see this thing. Now, most scholars, make a long story short, based on the description, most scholars think that Behemoth was a hippopotamus, right? Has anyone seen a hippopotamus in person? Yeah. We've seen them at the zoo, right? We see them there, and we see these big, giant, enormous creatures. And I think that the hippopotamus ends up being this picture of what grace in action looks like. Because notice, this is right after God says, okay, what would you do if you were me? Would you just wipe people off the face of the earth? And then he gives this example that's probably a hippopotamus. So notice how he describes it. Verse 15, he says, look at the hippopotamus, which I made along with you. He eats grass like cattle. Right? Hold that thought in your mind. He eats grass like cattle. Now it's going to go on to describe him. He says, look at the strength of his back, the power of the muscles of his belly, and he stiffens his tail like a cedar tree. The tendons of his thighs are woven firmly together. His bones are bronze tubes. His limbs are like iron rods. He is the foremost of God's works. Only his maker can draw a sword against him. Right? You get this picture here from me. This big, massive, huge animal that only God himself can raise the sword up against him. Only God himself is big enough to take him on. And I do think that there's a real example here that you see of God saying to Job, look, you can't even take him on. Now you want to take me on? But I think it's bigger than that. I think there's more of a lesson that we're seeing here. Because notice here, and I told you to hold this in the back of your mind, this big, giant, huge animal eats grass. Okay? Now, when I was on a mission trip in Kenya, and we took one day on a safari, and I will never forget, we're seeing wild lions, we're seeing giraffes. It's one of the coolest things I've ever seen. We're seeing all these things. And there's this little pride of lions, and we're seeing four or five lions there, and the guy's just kind of standing around, you know, he's standing outside of the truck, and he's like, you know, 20 feet away from them, and we're going, are you crazy? And he goes, oh, no, the lions are fine. It's the hippos you have to worry about. I went, really? The hippos? He goes, oh yeah, they will mess you up. Right? I'd never thought about that. I thought, you have to be afraid of the lions. And this guy was going, no, I'm afraid of the hippo. But I love this picture here for a minute. Because you have this incredible, monstrous beast that has so much strength, so much intimidation in him, so much that he can do. And he's not a carnivore. He eats grass. Now notice, it even goes on here. We need to keep reading here. Where are we? Right here. Verse 20, it says, the hills yield food for him, while all sorts of wild animals play there. You kind of catch that picture there? This big, monstrous thing that could take out anything if he wanted to, he eats grass, he eats his food there in the hills, and all the wild animals are just kind of playing there. You kind of catch this picture? I think that this is God reminding Job of so much more than just how powerless Job is. I think he's also reminding him of what grace and restraint looks like. Because the hippo, who could take out any of these animals, they're just playing around him. Don't have a care in the world about him. Why? Because he eats grass. He's not going to hurt them, even though he could. Right? I think that this is part of the reason that God talks about Behemoth right after he's just talked about, hey, would you wipe everybody off the face of the earth if you could? He's giving him this example of what grace in action looks like with an example of probably a hippo-like creature. It's probably a hippo that has all of this restraint. You even see verse 21 that, you know, even though the rivers are roaring over him, he doesn't care. He just sits in the water as the floodwaters come up to his nose, and he's like, okay, whatever, I got this. No big deal, right? It's almost this picture of what God is like. I think this is such a huge thing, okay, because God has just asked Job, would you really just wipe evil off the face of the earth? Would you wipe out anybody? Would you crush them into the ground? And then he gives an example of what grace in action kind of looks like, of a creature who could do that and doesn't do that. I think that that's part of why God is using the example of Behemoth, because he's trying to show them that. Because here's the thing, you know, we tend to think that we have all the answers, right? Job, he's been suffering, and he feels like his suffering is a waste. But it's not a waste in the eyes of God. The hippo that only eats grass just seems like such a waste of all those muscles and all that power, but it's not a waste in the eyes of God. So we tend to be people that we make judgments on what we think is right, what makes sense, and what doesn't make sense. We make those judgment calls, and we say, okay, this makes sense, and this doesn't make sense. The truth is that that becomes a very dangerous thing for us as humans to do. One of the first things you see in the decline of any civilization is you begin to devalue and dehumanize people. I want you to think about that for a minute, just how dangerous that is. We begin to dehumanize. We begin to devalue people. I'll never forget taking a class with one of the greatest apologists who ever lived, John Warwick Montgomery, who talks about how, first of all, we killed the idea of what the Bible is, right? Now all of a sudden, Darwin comes along and we go, oh, well, maybe God didn't create everything. Maybe it was evolution. Maybe it was all that. We begin to put that seed of doubt in there, right? Then after that, it was the idea that once you start killing the Bible, you start killing who God is. Okay, there is no God. God doesn't exist. He's just a figment of our imagination. He's just something we've made up, right? The next step in that progress, if you keep following that progression, is then you go, well, who are we? We start to devalue who we are. We start to go, okay, there's no real definition of what a man or a woman is. You can choose your own gender. You can choose all that kind of stuff. We begin to devalue just who we are as a people. And one of the ways I most see this is in the idea of abortion, right? I remember a couple of years ago, I shared one of my favorite Super Bowl commercials, and it was a Doritos commercial where a guy was sitting there eating a bag of Doritos while his wife was having a sonogram who was pregnant, right? You remember that commercial? Some of you remember it. It was a great classic commercial. So this baby's having a sonogram, and it's there on the monitor, and wherever he's going with the Doritos, the kid's following, you know, inside the sonogram. And he holds a chip over here, and the kid's attention turns that way. He holds a chip over here, and the kid's attention turns that way, you know. I will never forget, there was an abortion rights advocate group that tweeted out the next day. They criticized Doritos, and this was their terms. They said, for humanizing the fetus, right? They had a problem with them pretending that fetus was human, right? What happens is we begin to devalue who we are. You're going to see that this question about who God is and who man is such a huge part that makes a part of Job's thing here, of his explanation and the change that God brings in his life through all of this as he deals with those questions, who God is and who man is. But the truth is that sometimes we create our own moral crisis when we remove grace from the picture. When we get to judge who's worthy of life and who isn't. We get to be the one who decides, okay, does a... Joseph Fletcher was this famous guy who used to say that a Down syndrome person was not a human. They didn't say they're not a human, they said they're not a person. They don't count as a person because they have a mental defect, right? They said he's not a real person, right? What happens when we begin to devalue who we are is we take grace totally out of the picture. And grace is part of the character of God. All of a sudden, when this baby restricts freedom, requires this unselfish attention from us, and over the course of raising it, it's going to cost $200,000 to $300,000 over the course of 18 or 22 or 47 years, however long you're going to raise your kids, right? We go, okay, well, I don't get anything out of this, so I can just abort that pregnancy. It's no big deal because it's dehumanized. It's not a real person, right? So I think you have here Job who gets asked all these questions about God. And really what's underlying the current under all of that is about grace. It's about those questions of who we are. It's those questions of, would you really wipe out someone? And it might sound, I think, kind of silly to this that God uses this hippo in a bizarre way to help Job learn that lesson, but I think that he does. And then God brings up the Leviathan. Okay, the Leviathan, it might have been a mythological creature, but it was probably a crocodile, is the way most scholars think. You could make a pretty good case that the crocodile is what you kind of see here. But in contrast to this playful monster that doesn't, like a hippo, that doesn't really challenge anybody, doesn't really threaten anybody, other animals are playing all around him, but in contrast to that, God brings up the Leviathan. the animal that's probably a crocodile, an animal who doesn't care, really. And then God details all of these unsavory characteristics of the crocodile in this chapter. I love the way one of my commentaries said it. They said he detailed all of that in a chapter that might be entitled, "Everything You Always Want to Know About the Crocodile, But We're Afraid to Ask," right? So this crocodile gets described in these in verses 1 through 6 as uncatchable, unfeeling, untrustworthy, unmanageable, unplayful, undesirable, unhospitable, unethical. These are the words that you actually see described as the crocodile. And then you see this fascinating little thing here. Job 41, verses 3 through 5, this is what God asked Job about, a crocodile. He says, "Will the crocodile, will he beg you for mercy or speak softly to you?" Go to verse 5. This is where he says, "Can you play with him like a bird, or can you put him on a leash for your girls?" Oh, y'all, I've seen crazy things. We had this church member one time that would take his cat for a walk. You know, he could put a little cat on a leash, take him for a walk, and it was crazy. I have never seen anybody leash a crocodile and take it for a walk. Right? It is not going to happen. You know why? Because a crocodile doesn't care what you want him to do. He's going to do what he wants to do. In all these incredible ways that he has described, verse 12 actually says limbs that are mighty and graceful. You see in verse 13, skin that you can't even break through, a ferocity that's not even going to respond to a double bridle on him. You know, you see jaws that can't be opened, teeth that can't be counted in verse 14. You see scales in verse 15 that are like a coat of armor on him. You see all this incredible thing. You get the idea here. Verse 22 talks about strength, about his neck. He has this powerful neck. You actually see verse 23 that you can't penetrate his flesh. Verse 24 has this heart that's hard as stone, right? Sword and spear, verse 26 and 27, sword, spear, dart, javelin just bounce off him. Iron that's like straw, and bronze that's like rotting wood to him. He's so powerful and so strong. Verse 28 talks about how arrows don't even faze him, and darts are like straws, javelins are a laugh to him in verse 29. You kind of catch this picture of all of this. But notice that there is very few things on earth that is terrifying as a crocodile, truly. I mean, it really is. They're ferocious, they're fearless, they're formidable. In verses 10 through 11, God says this to Job. He says, "No one is ferocious enough to rouse Leviathan. Who then can stand against me? Who confronted me that I should repay him?" Notice what God says here. He says, "Everything under heaven belongs to me." Notice here this picture. You have this incredible animal that is just this incredible, powerful animal. And God makes a point of saying, look, the only person that can control him is me. Right? You can't control him, but I can. Everything under heaven belongs to me. You could put a leash on him and take him for a little walk. Would anybody have the courage to do that? Let me rephrase that. Would anybody have the stupidity to try that? Yeah, courage isn't the right word. Stupidity is a better word here for me. Right? And I think that this is such a huge thing because God is asking, Job, would you make this as a plaything for your girls? Would you let your daughters play with this? Would you have this little thing, you know, he's going to speak to you? You know, if a crocodile is making a noise towards you, you're going to wet yourself and run away as fast as you can. You're not going to be like, oh, how cute, he's talking to me. Right? You catch the picture here for me. This idea of this creature that is so huge that nothing can stand against him except for God himself really kind of captures all of our fears. And I think God is asking Job this question. He goes, you know, would you expect him to speak softly to you? And Job's going, no, I'd be too scared of him. Would you play with him like a bird? No, I wouldn't get near him because I'm scared of him. Would you put a leash on him and let him play with your girls? No, I would never do that because I'm scared of him. Right here, I want you to see this picture. And in this line of questioning, by the way that God is questioning that, he's bringing to mind Job's own fears. Right? Because I think what's coming down on all of this, what's really going on behind the surface, and y'all, keep in mind that this isn't about understanding God, this is about understanding Job. Right? Job, who has just lost everything. And he's scared. He doesn't know what to do. And I think that there's this big fear that he's going, God, I don't know where to go from here, but what happens if this happens again? What if this were to happen again? What if I were to have more kids and get more land again? But God, is there any guarantee that this isn't going to happen again? I think what's really happening here is it's coming down to fear. Fear of Leviathan is, I think, one of those ways that God is really trying to get down to the fear of what Job is really feeling. You kind of catch this picture here for a minute? Because what happens when things happen that don't make sense to us, right? Sometimes our questions about why God allows evil to happen, part of us is afraid that there's some deep, dark corner of creation that is outside of God's control. We think, okay, God, that surely couldn't happen. You surely wouldn't have allowed that to happen. So were you just not paying attention? Did you blink? Were you having a bad moment? You know, what happened there? The fascinating part about all this is God isn't going to answer Job's question about why he allowed this to happen. But I think he is acknowledging that real fear, because what happens when we think about bad things that happen is we go, okay, well, it had to be outside of God's control. Y'all, I'm a big person, and I always want it. There's always a why behind every behavior. And in everything we do, there's always a reason behind it. We, a lot of times, comfort ourselves in a way that I don't think we even mean to comfort ourselves, because we try and tell ourselves something we don't really believe. When something really bad happens, all of us, myself included, you know what our go-to is? Well, that must have been God's will. Right? That happened because that was God's will. Y'all, I'm going to tell you, murder isn't God's will. Rape isn't God's will. Child abuse isn't God's will. Elder abuse isn't God's will. There are a lot of things that happen that are not God's will. But rather than us go, there's this juxtaposition, there's this contrast, there's this fight going on between our free will and God showing grace and mercy. But that makes us so uncomfortable to think that we could have caused this, so we convince ourselves, okay, this was God's will. I remember one time when a five-year-old kid had gotten hit by a car, and someone said, well, this must have been God's time for him. And I remember thinking, I'm not so sure about that. And I'm saying this to say, I'm just trying to be transparent, I'm trying to be honest with you. What we've tried to do is we've tried to ignore our fears, haven't we? Because what's going on is we're going, okay, well, this had to be God's will if it happened, because it gives us some comfort. We feel like if this happened for a reason that we can understand, then it makes sense of it, right? So sometimes we lie to ourselves and we go, okay, this must have been God's will for this to happen. Y'all, sometimes that isn't God's will for that to happen. What it is God allowed it to happen in his grace and in his love for humanity. Probably God, let me back up, I don't mean to say probably God. God sometimes allows what we would consider an evil to happen, but what's happening is it's about our free will, but sometimes it's about stopping an even greater evil that we don't even understand. And Job has been asking these questions, God, I don't understand why this is happening. And Job is driven by his fear in a lot of ways because he just wants to make sense of it. And God is not going to make sense of it to Job. He's not. You know what he is going to do? He's going to let Job know, hey, I am here in the midst of all of this. You look at the last 2 weeks and everything we've looked at. Job, who's felt so forgotten, God goes, Job, you're not forgotten. Job, who goes, man, God, I don't understand why evil exists. And God goes, man, it's about grace. And I know that doesn't comfort you. It doesn't make you feel any better, but it's about grace. You've got Job who's going, God, I'm scared. I have all of this that's going on. And God's going, look, we've got this. It's okay. You don't have to have the explanation. You know why? Because you have me. Right? You see what was bigger than Leviathan? God. The God who hasn't forgotten Job. The God who has been there in the midst of all the questioning, in the midst of everything. God has been there in the midst of it all. And I want to read something that David McKenna wrote in his commentary on Job. He said this. He doesn't answer the plaintiff's question. Talking about Job, he said he doesn't answer Job's question, why? But he does address the ultimate question, who? When it comes down to all of our fears, we're afraid that some corner of creation is out of God's control, just like I shared earlier. And they said, no conundrum, no thing that we face is greater than the suffering of the innocent. And that is why God himself addresses himself to Job's fear rather than answering his questions of fact. Because unless we have all the facts of God's omniscient mind, we can understand the origins, the symptoms, the distinctions of all creation. Unless we have all of that, David McKenna says, our fears will remain. If, however, we are confident that there's no contingency, there's no event, there's no creature outside of the command of the God who cares for us, then we can bear the pain of suffering and live with mystery. Unencumbered trust is God's goal for his servant, Job. I think, God, when Job's been questioning his justice, God's going, Job, those are great questions. They are. But instead of focus on those questions, let's focus on something else. Let's focus on my grace. Let's focus on how I'm bigger than your fears. Let's focus on that. We're going to continue on. We're going to see the aftermath. We're going to see what happens when Job really has wrestled with all this. We're going to see the aftermath of what happens in Job's life. Y'all, I do want you to know, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks through this unusual questioning of Job by God, that God is going, Job, let me ask you these questions because you'll find your answers in those questions. And Job is seeing that he's not forgotten. He's seen that God isn't indifferent about all the pain and all the suffering he's going through. He has seen that every aspect of creation, God can do something about. So if he allows something to happen, there's got to be a reason for that. And he has learned, Job has said, he has learned, if I can just trust God, that is enough and that is okay. I don't need the answer to my why because I know the who. Right? We're going to talk about that more next week. This is, I think, God's answer for four chapters to Job is it's going, look, you've been asking all the wrong questions. Stop asking why and start trusting me. Start trusting your who. We'll finish this up next week, but let's bow in a word of prayer. God, we thank you so much that you love us so very much. We know that you're bigger than anything that we face. You know, we have people in this, I mean, God, we have people in this room that are facing some terrifying things. We have people that are facing sickness and things that just seem overwhelming. We have people that are facing emotional things. We have people that are looking back on their life and going, God, I don't understand how I got to this. But God, I pray that no matter where we are today, we'll be able to trust in one thing, and that's you. How you haven't forgotten us, how you love us, how you are there for us in the midst of everything we are going through. God, we don't need to have all the answers. We just need to cling to you. So we will pray. We pray that we will do that this week. Remind us of how much you love us. Remind us of how big you are this week. Remind us, just like you had to remind Job. And if you could do it with all the heartache in the meantime, I would appreciate that. I would love that. But if that's what it takes for me to recognize who you are, then let that be the case. Father, work in us. Help us to trust you. Help us to remind ourselves that you were there because you really, truly are. In your name we pray. Amen.